Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 2nd of December. The French government is teetering on the brink after Prime Minister Michel Barnier forced through a budget and now looks set to face a no-confidence vote that he's likely to lose. We'll examine where this leaves France and Europe. The Israel-Hezbollah ceasefire in Lebanon is looking increasingly shaky. We get the latest and we get an update on the rebel advance in neighbouring Syria. Plus, a defence of Joe Biden's decision to pardon his son Hunter and Kate Blanchett on how her latest political comedy offers an oasis of absurdity. When he began his job as the EU's chief Brexit negotiator more than 7 years ago, Michel Barnier was given a mountaineering book by his British opposite number, David Davis. Today, the French Prime Minister, Monsieur Barnier, faces what appears to be an unscalable political mountain as he tries to avoid becoming the shortest serving holder of that office. After parties on the left and right rejected his austerity budget with its tax rises and spending cuts worth around 60 billion euros, he triggered an article of the French Constitution which allows him to bypass the usual parliamentary approval, and he threw down a gauntlet to MPs.
I believe that we have now reached a moment of truth at which everyone must face up to their responsibilities. It's now up to you, the nation's parliamentarians, to decide whether our country is equipping itself with responsible financial texts that are essential and useful to our fellow citizens, or whether we are entering uncharted territory.
Well, that uncharted territory a French Prime Minister booted out of his job for the first time since 1962 would be entered if he loses a no-confidence vote that could flow from that decision, and it will do. According to Marine Le Pen, leader of the largest single party in the French Parliament, the hard-right National Rally.
We're tabling a motion of censure and we're going to vote it through because the French people have had enough. They've had enough of being thrashed. They've had enough of being mistreated. Some maybe thought that with Michel Barnier, things would get better. But they're even worse. We cannot leave the situation as it is.
With the biggest bloc on the left taking a similar line, Michel Barnier can only count on the support of the centrist third of what is an evenly divided parliament. So where do things go from here? Joining us now is Sophie Pedder, The Economist's Paris Bureau Chief. Good evening, Sophie.
Good evening.
So how did we get here?
Well, I mean, what you've just put your finger on it. It's a evenly divided three-way parliament with no majority for any of the blocs and a complete deadlock. And this is a situation that Michel Barnier inherited. So, you know, you could say it was all sort of pre-written when he started out in September. He was trying to sort of find the votes he needed to get this budget through. And it's important to remember that this budget is really important. I mean, it's not just any old year. This is a year when France has a very high public government deficit of about 6% in the current year, and he needs to get it down to 5% for next year. So it's an important moment for him to do this, but he was handed an almost impossible situation. And sure enough, you know, he's ended up with this deadlock parliament. So the chances are that he will be removed from office on Wednesday, and then President Macron's back to square one, which is where he was after calling the parliamentary election in June and July this year, which is to say he needs to find another prime minister who will give it another go. But, so, you know, it's not a question of just finding the right name. Structurally, it's an almost impossible situation.
And a situation that Monsieur Macron himself has created then?
Well, he was running a minority government for the last 2 years. Don't forget that he lost his majority at legislative elections in 2022, you see. So he was already, he'd spent 2 years with a minority government, thinking it might be possible to sort of possibly clarify that he wanted clarification. What that meant was never quite clear. But in any case, his majority shrunk and ended up with an even worse, smaller minority government. So yeah, in a way, he certainly didn't help his own situation with this. But it is, the fact is, I think the bottom line is that French public opinion is polarized. It's split into these three blocks. That has not shifted. Even if you were to hold parliamentary elections tomorrow, I don't think that would change. And this is,
which can't happen, of course, can it? Because those snap elections in July mean you can't have another one for another year. Is that right?
That's exactly right. The Constitution says you have to leave 12 months before calling one and calling another. So we could go on for months with this sort of deadlock situation. Fortunately for the budget, there are constitutional ways to get round it. And there could be a sort of a rollover budget that will allow France at least to kind of ticking over. There's no such thing as an American style shutdown. But it is unstable, and markets don't like that. Public opinion doesn't like that. Consumers don't like that. Businesses don't like that. It's making people feel edgy. So it's a really unhappy situation.
So what's the timing of this, and what then are the options open to President Macron?
Well, on Wednesday, we will in all likelihood have this vote of no confidence. It will probably go through. Barnier will have to resign, and his government too, but they'll be asked to stay on as in a caretaker role while Macron finds somebody else. But, you know, as I was saying, it's very difficult. You know, lots of names are out there. People can throw names that they like into the ring, you know, names from the left, names from the right. But the bottom line is that it's hard to see any of them being any better place to find a majority, because that's what you need. You know, the left saying it won the elections, which is true in the sense that it came top, but it also doesn't have a majority in parliament. So even if Macron were to ask somebody on the left to form a government, it would be in no better position to get a budget through. So this is the sort of deadlock we're facing. It's very difficult.
Sophie, many thanks. Sophie Penner, the bureau chief in Paris for The Economist. Well, let's hear from the left of French politics. Nathalie Auziol is an MP from La France Insoumise, or France Unbowed. It's the left-wing party, which is part of the bloc that has the largest number of seats in the National Assembly. And it was the first to declare that they would table a no-confidence motion. I asked her what her party hoped to achieve.
These are the last moments, the last hours of Barnier and his government, because he decided to use the 49.3 article of the Constitution, which, you know, allows him to force the budget he had planned. And he did so because he has no majority in the National Assembly to pass his bill. This government, this right-wing government, is not a reflection of the result of the elections. So this government is illegitimate. And,
but the trouble is, I suppose, is that that election did not produce a conclusive result. Your bloc in parliament may be the biggest, but it is far short of a majority. And whatever comes out next, if there is a change of government, as looks likely, it will be faced with that same arithmetic in parliament, won't it? It will still require some form of compromise to pass a budget.
A short majority is still a majority. And until 2024...
It's not a majority. Sorry, just to be clear, it's not a majority, is it? It's the biggest of the minorities. Well, it's not a majority in Parliament.
From 2022 to 2024, Macron's groups in the National Assembly were a relative small majority, and it did not prevent them from applying their politics. So why did the rule change now? You know, this is a democratic issue.
Well, they were able to get things through because there are enough MPs who would support, and that's not the case now.
Because they used the 49.3 article a lot, 24 times. There is one person, one single person who is responsible for the political chaos and the political instability in France, which is also a crisis in the regime. It is the President of the Republic himself, Emmanuel Macron. So now he must leave, whether by our impeachment or by his resignation. There are no good solutions.
Is that your red line then? No support for any new government unless the president steps down, which obviously will trigger a whole new set of circumstances.
Our position hasn't changed since July the 7th. Since the New Popular Front won the snap elections, there should be a government from the New Popular Front in France. But Macron decided he would not do such a thing. So this is the problem.
So now if he chooses someone from your party to lead the next government, is that a potential way forward?
We had a candidate, actually, who was Lucie Castet. She was the candidate for the whole New Popular Front parties, but Emmanuel Macron decided not to appoint her. So he was the one to dismiss, disregard, ignore not only the voice of the people, but the usual traditional political rules and constitutional rules. So now this is enough. I mean, Barnier will be dismissed on Wednesday and Macron must leave after him, because this is the only solution to this deep political crisis.
It's also an economic crisis, though, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
France doesn't have a budget. France has a huge and growing deficit. Its cost of borrowing is growing. It is an economic crisis right at the heart of Europe. What do you propose to do about that as the largest single bloc in Parliament?
There have been 3 months of debates in Parliament, which led to the vote of many new Popular Front amendments and a new budget conform to our programme. And our budget is based on the increase in receipts rather than cuts in expenses. We are ready to govern. We would be more serious than all the governments we have had in France for years.
Nathalie Auziol, a member of parliament from La France Insoumise, France Unbowed, a party on the left of the spectrum. Well, let's pick up on the implications of all this for Europe. And what about this crisis? What influence is it going to have on the financial markets and on Europe's political stability more generally? Joining us to discuss that, Midge Raman, Europe Managing Editor for the geopolitical risk firm, the Eurasia Group. Good evening, Midge.
Good evening.
So how are the markets reacting to this crisis?
I mean, I think they're nervous, right? I think a lot now depends on how quickly Macron can appoint a new administration and how quickly that administration can pass a budget for next year. I think that's what they are going to be looking at. And until there is certainty over those two facts, number one, the shape of the new government, and number two, the shape of the fiscal parameters for 2025, I suspect borrowing costs and market pressure will continue to rise.
What can a new government, and we're looking at a potential new government, Michel Barnier is still in place for the time being, but what can anyone do differently to what he's done?
I mean, I think now the game is going to be whether a version of the 2024 budget can be rolled over for next year. So what is the administration that Macron can put together that will just deliver that stopgap budget? That's what everybody, I think, is now looking at and will be focused on politically within France, but also externally the financial markets. Once that budget has been passed, I suspect we will probably move to a new political situation in France where a new government will need to be formed that will seek to implement a deficit-cutting budget that actually begins to bear down on the ever-increasing debt and deficit levels in France.
Is that not just putting off the inevitable, though? That deficit is above, way above the levels permitted in the European Union and has been in France for years, hasn't it? That's what Barnier's been trying to address, and that's been thrown out.
That's correct. I mean, the deficit is at 6.2% and Barnier was hoping to get it to 5% for next year. With all of the concessions and negotiating with Marine Le Pen, it was trending to 5.2%, 5.3%. I think that's part of the reason why Barnier said this thing is becoming farcical and I'm now really going to, you know, put myself at risk of this motion of no confidence. I do think given there's only a month left in the calendar year, all of the focus now will be on ensuring there is no government-style shutdown early next year. And there are different readings within the Constitution as to whether or not that is or is not permissible, whether a government with full powers can avoid it or whether a caretaker government can pass legislation that will prevent that happening next year. So I think that's really the game now. Can a version of this year's budget apply next year to make sure there is no shutdown early next year? And then, as I say, a new government will aim to put in place a deficit-cutting budget for 2025 that actually begins to get a hold of this debt and deficit.
In the meantime, then, this political and economic weakness in France, what impact is it having more broadly in Europe?
Well, I think the first thing it's obviously done is completely undermine Macron's credibility in Europe. You know, he ran as an economic reformer, somebody who was going to put France's fiscal house in order, address the chronic unemployment, was aiming to do that, build credibility in Germany and the rest of Europe, and then advance his own agenda in the EU for strategic autonomy, for more common borrowing, to begin to do the kinds of things Mario Draghi was talking about, you know, the big investment gaps in Europe and the need for common financing at the European level to address those investment gaps. I mean, that argument is harder for Macron to push in Europe when the domestic political and economic situation are in such a mess. If a government can't be put together quickly that rolls over the 2024 budget, then of course there, I think that there is much bigger risk of a more violent market reaction. And that could, over time, begin to impact other peripheral European markets as well. You could begin to see contagion, as we did earlier in the decade when the Greek financial crisis was hitting.
Midge, many thanks for that. Midge Vraaman, Europe Managing Director for geopolitical risk firm, the Eurasia Group. Well, from a government that's increasingly looking like a zombie government in France, later on we'll be hearing about politics and zombies.
What is this large brain?
A woman's brain, I would say.
She can only speak gibberish.
Swedish. She's just speaking Swedish.
That is from Kate Blanchett's new movie, Rumours. It's an absurdist comedy set during a G7 summit. I've been speaking to the actress about whether truth may be imitating fiction. Now, if the speed with which rebels captured Syria's second city, Aleppo, took everyone by surprise, the response to it has been fairly predictable. Syrian and Russian warplanes have been pounding civilian areas under rebel control. Those airstrikes were on Idlib, the northwestern region that has remained beyond the Assad government's control and from where the rebels made their foray southwards. Tonight, there are other signs of a government fight back. Iranian-backed militias from Iraq reported to have arrived across the border overnight. Mustafa Aladou is with the healthcare charity MedGlob. He's in Idlib, and from there, he told me about the Syrian government's response to the offensive.
The situation is very terrible, especially today. The Russian and the Syrian warplanes attacks many health facilities, many vital areas in the center of Idlib city, and the attacks also a camp. Seven civilians were killed in this camp, and many patients were killed in the Idlib a university hospital. Before the escalation, there was no any attack. But 5 days ago, they started to attack cities, health facilities, especially in Aleppo and Idlib city. They attacked the Aleppo University hospital 2 days ago after losing this city.
Now, they say they are attempting to attack facilities or sites that are helping the rebels from HTS and others, but you're saying they are attacking medical facilities.
Yes, we are witnesses. I was in Idlib city when they attacked the Idlib Health Directorate and maternity hospital and the dialysis center and national hospital. We sent a medical staff from Idlib to Aleppo to help to provide health services in Aleppo University Hospital. And we lost one ambulance driver and guard in front of the Aleppo University Hospital.
Is this the same approach by the Assad government to the one that it took in the earlier days of the civil war, 8 years ago?
Yes. Actually, we are, as a Syrian people, we are very familiar to these attacks. More than 600 health workers were killed in the past years. Assad regime and Russian used to attack health facilities when they lose any area. So we are very familiar to these attacks.
Mustafa Aladou with the healthcare charity MedGlobal speaking to me from Idlib. Well, what is the reaction been to this offensive amongst Syrians here in the UK, many of whom are opposed to the Assad regime? I'm joined now by Robin Yassin Kassab, British Syrian author and a critic of the Assad government. Good evening, Robin.
Good evening.
How important is this moment, do you think?
Well, it remains to be seen, but it's immensely important. We don't quite know where it's going, and it's come kind of out of the blue. Everything was frozen for years, and then suddenly years worth of events have happened in a few days. So it's immensely important.
Now, the group that is leading this rebellion, if we can call it that, HTS, it is an Islamist group. It originally came from a group that was sort of allied to Al-Qaeda, but how would you characterize it now?
Well, it's great. It's still an authoritarian Islamist organization, but it's greatly moderated. It's split definitively from ISIS, then from Al-Qaeda. It fought ISIS. It split from Al-Qaeda. It purged the Al-Qaeda people and the extremists in its ranks, and it's tried to really moderate and become a Syrian organization rather than a transnational jihadi organization. It doesn't threaten the West. It doesn't have a religious police like ISIS had. It doesn't go out arresting people for infringements of its behavioral code. It's built good relationships, or much better relationships than in the past, with Christians and other minority groups. And to an extent, it tolerates opposition. I mean, in comparison with the Assad regime, it tolerates opposition. And, you know, there have been demonstrations against HTS in Idlib for months on end, because they arrest people for political reasons and sometimes torture them. If that was in Assad territory, the protesters would all be shot dead or arrested and tortured. But in HTS territory, it's quite a bit more tolerant. And then it's great to see, it's really quite surprising to see that in Aleppo today, now that they've arrived in Aleppo, they seem really very disciplined, much more disciplined than I would expect. They've clearly learned a lot of lessons. There have been no verified attacks on minorities. Women are walking around freely without hijabs. The electricity is on. And they're presenting themselves as a national group here to get rid of the dictatorship and then allow the people to decide what comes next.
Well, getting rid of the regime, I mean, is that something you hope will happen? Are the conditions there for it now?
I really don't know if the conditions are there at the moment. It really depends what's happening in the next hours, but they could be. Because remember, when the Assad regime took Aleppo back from the revolution, from the people of Aleppo, at least eastern Aleppo, back in 2016, it didn't do it with the Syrian army. 80% of the ground forces fighting for Assad were Iranian organized Shia militias from Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the air force was Russian. It was Russian bombers. The Assad regime is hated by at least 4/5 of the population. It's expelled 13 million people from their homes. It's killed hundreds of thousands, and it's cratered the economy and the civilian infrastructure. So people don't like it, and it's been kept in power, frozen by foreign powers, mainly Russia and Iran, but also others too. And Russia, of course, is preoccupied in Ukraine at the moment. And Iran's militia system in the area, in the region, has just been hammered as a result of the Israel war. So but now that the backers of the regime are kind of much weaker, then suddenly the unsustainability of the regime comes to the fore. And I think that's what's happening.
Robin, many thanks for joining us. Robin Yassin Kassab, British Syrian author there. Well, Robin talked about what was happening in neighbouring Lebanon, and there the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah is nominally in place, but there has been a marked increase in military activity today. It was hoped that the ceasefire, which was finalised by the US and France last week, would bring to an end more than a year of conflict across the Israel-Lebanon border. Well, a short while ago, I got the latest from our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison.
Well, look, this ceasefire has only been in place for a matter of days, and if it's not over, it's looking pretty fragile. So within the last hour or so, we've had the Israeli military confirming that they have carried out strikes on what they call Hezbollah terrorists, rocket launchers, and their infrastructure throughout Lebanon. Earlier, we had two rockets fired over from Lebanon over the border, and Israel said that was a breach of the ceasefire and that they were going to hit back hard. Earlier in the day, Hezbollah says it was Israel that had broken the ceasefire with airstrikes that killed two people in Lebanon. So, as I say, if there is still a ceasefire in place, it's not looking very steady.
And from the Israeli government, what are they saying about this?
Well, we've had Prime Minister Netanyahu saying that Israel would respond with force to any attacks from Hezbollah. We've also had similar comments from the Israeli Defense Minister, Israel Katz. And on the more extreme far-right side of the Israeli government. The Minister Smotrich there calling really for a dramatic escalation and for Israel to hit back hard. So we're getting strong comments from the Prime Minister, Mr. Netanyahu, but he has pressure from the right of his coalition to hit back even harder.
And anything from the international partners who helped to broker this ceasefire?
Well, I think there's considerable dismay and calling for a de-escalation. As I say, it's only been in place for a matter of days. This ceasefire had been in the works for weeks, if not months, particularly the Americans pushing hard for it. And it was something of a result, I suppose, in the dying days of the Biden presidency that this ceasefire had been put in place. But as I say, just a matter of days old and it's faltering.
That was John Donison, our correspondent in Jerusalem. Now, ever since he stepped down as a presidential candidate, but even more so since his Democratic Party lost the US presidential election, Joe Biden has rather faded into the background of American life. Today, though, he has returned to the front and centre.
This is an ABC News special report.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Lindsay Davis at ABC News headquarters here in New York. We're coming on the air this hour with breaking news. President Biden has just pardoned his son Hunter on gun and tax charges that he was facing.
That decision to issue a full and unconditional pardon for his son Hunter Biden, covering his convictions for federal gun and tax charges, was a reversal of the president's earlier position. And beyond that, Mr. Biden has asserted the convictions were politically motivated. In a statement, he said, "The charges against his son came about only after several of my political opponents in Congress instigated them to attack me and oppose my election." Well, that has caused consternation amongst Republicans and some Democrats, but not for my guest, Jasmine Crockett, a Texan Democratic Congresswoman. Good evening.
Good evening.
Why not? Some of your colleagues, I mean, let's quote some of them, Republican representative, I should say, Greg Stanton, saying this wasn't a politically motivated prosecution. Hunter committed felonies and was convicted by a jury of his peers. That's a pretty typical one. Many are pointing to that fact that this was a conviction by a jury of his peers. Why should that be characterized as political?
Yeah, so a couple of things, and I respect my colleague Greg Stanton a lot, but as someone who serves on the Oversight Committee and as someone who practiced criminal defense work for almost two decades, both in multiple states as well as federal courts, I can tell you that I am still hard pressed to find. And if you interview a Republican that can tell you that someone has been prosecuted under U.S. law for filling out an application to obtain a gun and having been at the time an addict of some sort, a drug addict of some sort, and somehow ultimately being prosecuted for that, well, that would be a first for me. I have never seen it happen. And while it is on the books, we have so many laws on the books, such as adultery and things like that, that just aren't prosecuted. So the fact that it was prosecuted in the first place tells me that this was a political motivation. We also know that typically when people fail to pay their taxes and get caught up, usually what happens is they are offered an opportunity to pay their restitution. And if they pay their restitution, they benefit from that in some way.
Can I just quote someone else at you? "I will accept the outcome of this case and will continue to respect the judicial process as Hunter considers an appeal." That is Joe Biden on the day of that conviction. And that's the problem there, isn't it? Because he and his press secretary have repeatedly said that they would not do this. And they have.
I don't think it's a problem. And I'm going to tell
why not?
You why.
Politically, it's not a problem when your party is accusing the Republicans of using the law politically to then have the president turn around and do a U-turn this way.
Now, why would it be a problem? Because when we start to talk about the opposition, the only people that can criticize us would be the opposition party. The opposition party has decided that a 34-count convicted felon should sit in the White House, something that has never happened in the history of this country. Not to mention, he just recently decided to appoint somebody that he had given a pardon to, a family member of his, one of his children's father-in-laws, in addition to all of the people that have surrounded him. So as far as I'm concerned, what is good for the goose is good for the gander. We know.
Well, isn't the American public going to think that as well? And you get this, they're all as bad as each other.
Well, listen, I think that that's what we have been getting in the first place, to be perfectly honest. The difference is that wasn't the reality, in addition to the fact that when we start to look at what has motivated the prosecutions of these other people that Trump ended up pardoning, not to mention Trump has already said he campaigned and said that he was going to pardon insurrectionists. So if he can go and decide that he wants to pardon insurrectionists, I don't know why anyone should be clutching their pearls or upset. Because the president took a long look at this and decided, you know what, I am going to change course. And that is the beauty of this situation, is that he is the president and he does have this power. And so, he has decided that this is how he was going to use it.
Okay, but if and when, as you suggest, Donald Trump does pardon people involved in those January the 6th riots, does your party then have a leg to stand on?
I think that we always have a leg to stand on, because you're talking about an insurrection that caused people to literally die versus a guy who was a drug addict at the time. And we still cannot find another prosecution in this country in which someone has been prosecuted in that way. And I would tell you that if his last name was not Biden, he would not have been prosecuted in this way. Not to mention, yes, tax evasion is always prosecuted. Now, let's be very honest about that. But usually when somebody gets tax evasion, let me tell you something, it's usually a gangster that they were having a problem with, and they negotiated that case down to say, you know what, we're just going to do tax evasion instead.
Congresswoman,
I'm afraid
we have to leave it there, but thank you so much, Congresswoman from Texas, Democrat Jasmine Crockett there. We're going to stick with politics now, but in a rather different context. The annual meeting of the leaders of the G7 group of industrialized nations. Not a phrase to set the pulses racing, unless it is you're talking about the fictional G7 summit in Germany, which forms the backdrop to Rumours. It's a new film by the Canadian filmmaker Guy Maddin. The summit's German host is played by Oscar-winning actress Kate Blanchett, and she takes her fellow leaders to a gazebo in the woods to thrash out a statement on an unnamed global crisis. She's also part of a leader's love triangle in an absurdist comedy that pokes fun at political leaders, including a US president played with no attempt at an American accent by distinguished British actor Charles Dance. There are also subplots involving zombies, a giant brain, and an AI chatbot.
We had to flee the gazebo. We were attacked by dark, shadowy figures.
Protesters.
That's what I thought too at first. But they didn't have signs. They didn't chant any slogans, And if they objected to any specifics in our program, they didn't say so.
Well, I've been speaking to Kate Blanchett and to the film's director, Guy Maddin, and we began with the film's opening shot, the so-called family photo of G7 leaders together.
The G7 manages to come up with family photos every year that are more just latently and overtly and explosively hilarious. They just have such awkward looks on their faces, but they're all united by some alpine backdrop or seaside vista. I don't know. It's just odd.
Kate, your character, well, you had a lot of fun with her, didn't you?
Yes, no. I mean, absolutely. I think I was the only one. Well, Charles as well, Charles Dance, who wasn't playing their own cultural stereotype. And it just seemed like a fantastic way to approach the systemic failures of the world from a warm-hearted human place.
Well, it is very human, and relationships, and your character, of course, is one who has a relationship in the film with the Canadian Prime Minister. It's we're getting under the bonnet, things that we, I guess, sort of imagine or wonder what is happening at those big meetings. Was that an important part of this view, Kate?
Yes. I mean, I'd never read anything like it. I think the screenplay, and I think the film does as well, it really sort of deliberately and often perversely, with hilarious results, sort of shifts tone. It's partly a political satire, but then as soon as you think it is, it's a soap opera, it's a monster movie, it's a B-thriller. We always wonder what happens in the corridors of power. And often it's just people saying, can I have a cheese sandwich? You know, and I think that was part of the thing I loved, is that once their assistants and then were gone and they didn't have any mobile phone service, they didn't know who they were.
This is obviously a very visual movie. It looks amazing. But language is really important, isn't it? I mean, not just this rather bland statement that they spend the whole movie working towards at the end, these sort of political vagaries,
But you know, you've got this, I found it hilarious sequence where Alicia Vikander's character comes in and they're trying to work out what language she's speaking. It's obviously sweet. She's a Swedish actress, we know that. But they go through about a dozen different languages.
What is this large brain?
A woman's brain, I would say.
She can only speak gibberish.
Swedish. She's just speaking Swedish.
For you, how where does sort of the language fit into this film?
I think, you know, as you say, a lot of that bureaucratic speak is often designed to offend no one and achieve nothing, you know, and so it can get very frustrating, I think, to Eddie around in it. But of course, you know, everything is so, it's very easy to judge these things until you're actually in the situation where you're trying to prevent a nuclear war and make sure that, you know, trade can still continue through war zones and across cultures. It's a really complex thing. I think it takes a lot of energy, actually, and a lot of selflessness to lead a country and a nation. And I think what I love about it is that even in the midst of this sort of apocalyptic backdrop, and they're set upon by sort of these floppy antagonists who are self-pleasuring in the background, they don't know what's going on, they never lose their civility or their kindness to one another.
Well, look, it does rather sort of beg the question. You've taken the G7 as your sort of starting point. There are kind of competing political blocks in the world now. There's a, you know, the BRICS, where you've got Russia and China. I mean, would that be a starting point for a sequel, perhaps, Guy?
It seems like this is endless. Do you remember those continuous towels? You probably don't have them in the UK anymore.
Oh, yes. They're very unhygienic.
Yeah, right. They just recycle the same stuff. It's sort of a moldy strip of linen teeming with germs. It seems to me like G7 summits are like one big continuous towel.
Continuous towel.
is there anything? I mean, you say you know it's difficult to be a leader. I mean, is there anything we should take from this film positive about politics?
I mean, we all know things really important. Problems and issues and challenges facing us as a species get politicized incredibly quickly. And what doesn't happen is they don't fracture as a unit. And so it does become sort of like a family saga more than a political satire. I find it terribly tragic and quite endearing where they all get to by the end of the film. But it's like a fever dream. I think people have to go into it thinking more Buñuel than, you know, a documentary about the G7. And I think, personally, I found it a relief to exist in that state of mind for a little bit. It's a little island of absurdity away from the actual terrifying absurdity that faces us all right now.
Cate Blanchett and director of Rumours, Guy Maddin. Our closing headline tonight, the minority government in France is on the brink of collapse as MPs prepare to hold a no-confidence vote. It was sparked by a decision by the Prime Minister Michel Barnier to use special constitutional powers to force through a controversial budget without parliamentary approval. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone here, good night.